And we are live just about a minute, maybe a minute and a half early today. Finally got caught up. I was almost late. Matt was waiting for me, and I was dealing with all kinds of crap. This has been an amazing week, and I just want to thank everybody today for making it an amazing week by supporting my book. That's been the bulk of what I've been dealing with this week in a good way. But I've also had a lot of other things going on. Of course, we are working on the fall workshop. I'm starting to line some things up for that. Negotiating with the location. It's going to work out, but we have a new location we're doing at instead of at our house. That's going to let us bring more people in and a few other things going on. So I just feel like I've done 2 weeks worth of work in 3 days this week, but yet somehow we actually kicked off a minute early. So with that, what are we going to be talking about today? Well, we're doing a series called Get to Know Your Expert Counsel. And I think this will help us get more questions for the counsel and more on-point questions for the council. Today, Matthew Sersley, who is known as the Agorist Tax Advisor, will be on. And we're going to be talking about tax advice for feral humans. What's a feral human? Well, hopefully, if you've been tuning in for a while, a feral human is you, right? Feral means that we're in our wild state, which is really a different term, right? We call it, that's a wild lion. No, that's a lion in its natural state. Right? It's a wild dog. No, that's a dog in its natural state when it's not domesticated. It does dog things, or it does wolf things, or it does lion things, or it does snake things or turtle things. Like, we take these animals, we domesticate them. There's a purpose to that. But when they're out in nature doing the thing that they do, they're not wild or feral. It's just terms we use. They're just natural. So to me, a feral human is a human that acts like a human instead of a domesticated species, which is what our owners and overlords want from us. And one of the main ways they control us is through the system of taxation. You earn money and they take a portion of it. The thing is, they have to pay taxes too. They don't want to pay taxes any more than you do. So they wrote this thing called tax code. And in that tax code, about 95% of it tells us what we do to get out of the 5% that says what we have to do. I've been putting it that way for years. And so when Matt came on the scene a few years ago, I was like, this is perfect. And so we've had him on a couple times, and he served on the expert council for quite a while now as well. And that's what we're going to talk about today, being that natural state human and wanting to keep what you've rightfully earned, but not wanting to do something like become even more domesticated. The ultimate domestication is when they stick you in a cage. Well, none of us want that, or put you on further restrictions like garnishing wages because you did something you weren't supposed to. So big old slap on the wrist, or sometimes a good beating maybe is what it'd feel like from the state. We're going to talk about how to avoid that, but also how to avoid giving them more than you have to based on their own rules today. Before we do that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is Above Phone, where you can break your limits and go above with great devices that let you take back your tech and your privacy. They've got the Above Phone, the Above Tablet, and the Above Book. I recently became an owner of an Above Book. I love it. It's fast, it's light, it works great, and it protects my privacy. You can have all of that by shopping at Above Phone, and if you buy any phone at Above Phone and are an MSB member, you'll get $75 off. And if you're worried about the onboarding experience, if you're like, but this is new, this is different, it is a little bit. And to me, it's actually a lot like this. It's different, but it's just because things are in different places. If you can use a computer, you can use an Above Book. If you can use an iPhone or a Google Android phone, you know, you can use an Above phone. One time, for instance, I was at my nephew's, and he was asking me to do something on it, how to do something on an app. And he handed me his phone, and it was like, because he has his icons in different places. That's all it was. And just, okay, once I found it. So it's a lot like that, but you still might need some help. Well, Above Phone is great. They'll give you an onboarding free consultation with every new device. Check them out today at abovephone.com. And remember, if you are buying a phone from them, get into your MSB account and get that discount. $75, that's 1.5 times. Your annual membership right there. Next up today is the Wealth Studying Podcast with John Pugliano. And hey, look, John's a good guy. His latest issue is about my book and telling people they should read it. So I really appreciate that. I also appreciate that John is one of the expert council members, and he might be the longest serving current expert council member at least in one form or another, since I met him back in 2010, and he's been part of this community since then. And he is a great investment advisor, but he's not just that. He's one of us. He's a prepper. He's a ham radio operator. He grows a garden. He stores surplus food. He practices what we teach and what we preach here at the Survival Podcast. Tune in to learn all about how to grow your wealth like you grow a garden with the Wealth Studying Podcast, again with John Pugliano. With that, let's go ahead and get our special guest on with us. I want to say, hey, Matt, man, welcome to the Survival Podcast again.
Thank you. Great to be back.
I'm glad to have you on. Let's start off with, you're an attorney by trade. There had to be a point in your life before that where you did other things. What led you down the path of the law and to become an attorney? It's not a quick path. It's not inexpensive. It's difficult. It requires a lot of effort. What made you take that path in the first place?
I was stupid. No. I got super into politics in college, and okay. I really wanted to get involved in politics and make changes. And I did no research whatsoever. I'm just like, oh, I'll be a constitutional lawyer and do that sort of thing without realizing that there's about 7 people who do that, and they all went to Harvard.
Yeah.
So I went to law school. And then I got out of law school, and it's like, oh, I need a job doing something. I need to find something to do that is not constitutional law, because even the people with those jobs doesn't pay very well.
Mm-hmm.
So, but before that, actually, before I wanted to be a lawyer, I was going to be a math teacher.
Okay.
I loved math. I was a math major, computer science minor in college. And so the goal was to be a math teacher or math professor for a long time. And kind of in my senior year of college, just totally went a different direction.
That's interesting. The lawyer thing and politics, the reason I smirk and laugh at that, my nephew, who graduated a few years ago, then clerked for a federal judge, and is now actually working as an assistant AG in Nebraska. That's why he went to law school, because he was going to be a senator. And then he paged for Senator Sass over a break. And when he came home after that, I said, so what do you think about the Senate now? And he goes, the government can't do anything. It just totally, like, even though he's in like a government job now, like the political side of it, he's like, no, they can't do anything. Like, it just completely purged every bit of it from his soul, even though that was his initial, like, drive. And I don't know what makes a guy that young want to be a senator, but he did. That was his goal. He was going to one day be a senator somewhere, and then that just died the day he actually saw what it looked like to make the sausage.
It's a common story for people going to law school. A lot of them want to be politicians or be involved in politics or – I mean, you look at Congress, and I think a majority of them are lawyers.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's an easy path to get there. It's not the only path to get there, but it's an easy path to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's get into the topic today. Now, people think that I come up with all these crazy marketing terms for this show, but Feral, tax advice for the feral human, that was actually your suggestion. I'm like, I'm going to run with that. So let's see how you define that. I kind of gave my view of that, but what does it mean to be feral when it comes to taxes and money, and how do you define the mindset that goes with it?
So to me, it's being feral with regard to taxes and being a human is you want to get out of the pen. You want to get out to get as much freedom as you can get without getting into trouble. You know, you want to pay as little in tax as possible, but as you mentioned, like if you break the rules or go too far, you know, you end up in a cage somewhere or bankrupt or both. So there's also a bit of I was thinking of, you talk a lot about, you know, pigs are feral, cows are domesticated.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like those pigs, they're smart enough to know to get out, but I think they're smart to know if they get out too often, they end up in the pot a little bit quicker.
So when they get out, they keep going, right? That's the other thing.
Yeah.
Like, if they get out, they go. They don't hang around outside the fence and wait for the 3006.
Yeah, so when I was thinking about that and proposed that as a topic to you, it was really kind of the how are we, you know, be more wild, be more natural, be more authentically human. And part of being authentically human is, you know, being, you know, taking calculated risks and not being too dangerous, not being too risky.
Absolutely. So I think one of the things that makes the average person's eyes gloss is talking about taxes. Like, they just immediately, like, I know I have to do it, and I'll do it, but I don't want to do it. But more than they don't want to do it, they don't want to talk about it. If you don't talk about it, you don't understand it. And I think that's one of the biggest ways that we are kept in control by the state is we make this really complicated, really convoluted with a whole big giant fear factor of horrible things will happen if you don't do it the way we tell you to. And by the way, we don't really tell you what to do. We don't really answer any questions. We don't tell you what you owe us. It's up to you to figure it out. And if you're wrong, then we'll punish you. Right. So with that in mind, why do you think it's like really important for people who value freedom to like understand the tax system, and specifically, like I talk about, the part of the tax system that tells you how to get out of doing the thing they say you have to do, especially even if they hate it?
You know, it really comes down to that fear that you don't want to learn about it, you don't want to get into it, you don't want to talk about it. That's the domestication of you. That's they've already made you so frightened you're not even willing to look into it. And like the fact of the matter is, you know, I'm an attorney. I do this. I have not read the entire tax code. No human being has read the entire tax code because it keeps changing. You don't have to know everything. Learning bits and pieces is still valuable. And yeah, sometimes there are special rules where the general rule doesn't apply. So that's why you work with a professional if it's a big deal. But, you know, it is fear. It is avoidance. And realistically, you don't need to be that scared because the fact of the matter is, as long as you're not committing fraud on your taxes,
yeah,
the punishments are all just money. And
well, you don't want to give them anyway, right?
Well, and right. But it's like I know a lot of people who are it's like, oh, I don't want to go to jail or go to prison. Or it's like, hey, as long as you're not committing fraud, you're probably not going to. Yeah. I mean, yeah, maybe you're legitimate, then they prosecute for fraud anyway, but like it's just money. And the other thing I talk about with clients is, you know, let's say, you know, a lot of the tax code is gray area. So let's say we find something that if we're right about it, it's going to save you $100 a year. Okay. And if you're wrong, you're just going to owe the $100 a year, plus you're going to owe interest when they catch you. Well, 8% interest... okay, let's do that 10 times. I lose on one of them. I save $900 on the ones I'm right. I pay maybe $100 in interest on the one I'm wrong. I come out $800 ahead. So it's like, again, it's that practical, you know, strategic risk of I don't know which way this is going to go, but I have a good faith belief that this is the way it will work. And as you just, you know, put down, like that's if they ask you, if they catch you, if they look into it. Because the fact of the matter is most of the numbers in your bookkeeping don't show up on your tax bill. So they don't know, you know, oh, you spent $73 on a meal on this date on your tax forms.
Correct.
So until they come to you and they ask, you know, hey, we need receipts, we need documentation, we need to, you know, hey, you wrote off $6,000 a meal this year. That's a lot of meals. Give us more information. Unless you do that, they're not going to ask. Now, that's not a reason to lie because they do ask. I think about once every 3 to 4 years, I tend to get a letter from the IRS asking for an explanation on something. But again, like it's not the end of the world. I mean, I'll be honest. I get that letter from the IRS. My heart goes, you know, beats a little bit faster. But the fact of the matter is it's never been that big of a deal.
Yeah, and I think having a good CPA helps with that too. Like, I've gotten some of those, I call them nastygrams, and they're not really an audit. They're just, we believe that you owe us this because of that, unless you can explain it. I don't write that letter. I go to my CPA, and he, and now she is, I was handed off by, like, my guy's, you know, apprentice, writes that letter for me, and I've had three in the last 15 years, so yeah, about once every 5 years. And two of them I won, and one of them I ended up paying them like 10% of what they said I owed. And, you know, the strategies we're using are saving me tens of thousands of dollars a year, not hundreds of dollars a year. So that's, if I had to pay all three of them, I'd still be ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, again, that's one of those things. I've literally seen letters where it's like, you owe us $74. Just pay it.
Yeah.
It's not worth your time. Just pay it.
Yeah, $74. I'm not incurring the bill that my accountant's going to charge me. No, they wanted like $300. That's we're going to fight that.
Yeah, and kind of my rule of thumb is, if it's $200 or $300 or $400, maybe just send the letter yourself, because again, if you lose, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
But if it's $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, and again, especially if they're not right, because sometimes like you get the letter like, oh yeah, you're right, I owe the money.
Yeah.
But if you're not right,
One time I had a capital gain on a stock trade, and it was my error. I just didn't remember that one. It just didn't get on the thing. It was like an E-Trade account, so it was out of all my other stuff, and it was like a $2,600 trade, but they assumed there was no – like it was free. Like somebody just magically dropped it in my lap, and I ended up – I owed them taxes on about an $800 gain. And once I sent it back and they said, okay, it's adjusted, then, okay, here's your money.
Yeah, I actually, when my last year of law school, I imported everything wrong into my tax program. And I did going back 1 year instead of the calendar year. And I had sold a bunch of stock, and so I didn't have my basis. So literally the week before I took the bar exam, I get a letter from the IRS saying I owed them $67,000.
Okay.
After I did the math and fixed it all, they owed me $17.
There you go. That's always fun. Actually, you owe me money, but look,
kind of going back to the topic again, it's like any one of these strategies, learning any one thing about how the tax code works is probably going to save you money.
Yeah.
And so while you shouldn't specialize in it, you should not spend, weeks learning about taxes. Learning the basics and then working with somebody who does specialize in it is a really good way to, save a bunch of money and maybe sleep a little bit better too.
Yeah, and I think we can learn something if you've ever had a job where you incur expenses and you submit an expense report, there's a certain way and a procedure you do that. And that's so the financial people that work for your company, if they're audited, they have everything complete, they'll bring boxes in and go, here you go, right? And we're talking to mostly probably solopreneurs or very small businesses, two or three people working for them, maybe some contractors working for them. You don't maybe need to be that thorough, but one of the things I do is I do a simple printable piece of paper, purpose of dinner, who was there, what was discussed, and just handwrite, fill that out. And that receipt gets stapled to that and that goes in an envelope. And that way, if we're ever audited, because that would be one of the few places that, if somebody starts really an auditor starts really probing, was this really a business? That's where you need more detail other than, yes, I went on a trip and here's my taxi receipt. Piss off. That's a place where they can say, was this really a business meal? And having those details, I think that would go a long way. I've never been through that level of an audit with my business, but that seems like a very simple thing to do.
Yep. Yeah. And meals in particular, the good rule of thumb is keep the receipt. Make a note of who was there, make a note of what was discussed and why it was beneficial for the business. And my QBO account, your QuickBooks Online account, has a place for me to actually make that note in my QuickBooks account.
Okay.
I can't lose that.
That's excellent.
It's stored. I guess if I stop paying for QuickBooks, I might have to access it. But other than that, I've got a digital record on the cloud backed up 17,000 times. So it's always there. And in fact, I can make that note from the app on my phone at the end of dinner, take a photo of the the app. It automatically puts it in. And then when the credit card statement comes, it sees, okay, same day, same number, and just automatically attaches that receipt to that item in my QuickBooks.
See, I'm old Gen X. I do everything in Excel. I generate my income statement out of Excel, and I have hard copies of everything. And it's just how I came up, so it's what I still do. And what you're doing is probably better for the average person. But I would also say this, if you are making significant money with a business of your own and you are doing your own taxes, unless you're somebody like Matt or a CPA, you're probably wrong. You should have a good CPA. And some of the things my CPA will do is I'll bring things in. If I have any question about whether or not I should call this even I know it's an expense, but does this go in marketing? Right. Or does this go into some other category? I'll bring it to her and then we'll do some last minute adjustments on the income statement that we use to do the taxes at that point. Or I'll call her and say, hey, this is what we did. What do I call this? Because a lot of times what you call things matters. The other thing is, any good CPA today should have fairly good software that when you're done, it says, hey, you know, that meal expense based on your income and everything else in your history is a bit high, and you might want to reduce it. And, you know, that's probably a good call, and you can always find other expenses somewhere else to offset it. Like, but I've had that with her like 2 years ago. Our meal expenses are really high, and she's like, I'd knock this down about $1,500. Yeah, do it. Like, just, and we just underreported it. There's no crime in underreporting an expense. Underreporting revenue, sure, but you don't have to report all your expenses.
Yeah, and the other thing, though, is, like, so those programs exist, but it's also why it's important to have a human being and not just some AI do it.
Yeah.
Because, like, I've got a client who is literally a traveling salesperson.
Okay.
On the road 200 days a year. So, yeah, his meal expenses are incredibly high relative to his revenue because he's eating 200 days a year.
Yeah.
And again, like it flew up a flag. Like, hey, this is a very high number. And it's like, I'm not worried about that at all because for his business, that is a very, very reasonable number. And in fact, on his case, we did the per diem for the meals anyway.
Because he was
like he'd actually usually get like, you know, a hotel that had a kitchen and would make his own food, and so could use the per diem and save even more money.
And that's like, everything in context, right?
Exactly. And so that's why, again, like learning general principles is good, and there's general principles about don't spend more than this on this category, but your business is different.
We have a lot of people here that are homesteaders. They're doing side hustles. They're trading crypto, et cetera. How can someone kind of live outside the box that way and make sure they stay out of any legal hot water?
So there are certain things I'm not going to say because I am a lawyer and I have a license.
Yes.
But, you know, as a practical matter, if you are making some fence post money, you should report that. But if you don't, I don't think that anyone's ever going to know.
Yeah. Yeah.
A big part of what I do is helping people find money they're spending and turn it into a business expense. You know, if you have a homestead and you're raising animals for yourself, but you're selling off animals for other people, you've got a business there. And you should be doing things like deducting mileage when you have to drive out to get feed. You should be doing things like writing off at least some of your internet bill, some of your phone bill. One of my last expert counsel segments was on home offices. If you can have a home office, you should have a home office. You know, this is all, and if you're already spending the money anyway, but you make it a tax write-off, you're saving, for most people, 22 to 30 cents per dollar. So you come up with, I mean, even $2,000 of business expenses, okay, that's $400 more in your pocket. You know, you're not going to, you know, retire off that or anything, but I'd rather have that money than have the government have it. So
well, you're not going to retire on it, but think about it this way. If you save $400 a year that way and you add it to your IRA contributions over 40 working years, it may not be your retirement, but it sure as hell boosts it.
Yeah, or if you put that money into Bitcoin 10 years ago, you probably could retire today.
You could have retired now, right? Yeah. Yeah. Especially if you did it every year over the last 10 years, right?
Exactly. So like, and I'm really big into, you know, whatever side hustle you have, and I hate to say this, the one good thing about the IRS, and there is a good thing, is that because people pay taxes, they have to take their business more seriously. And I cannot tell you the number of people who had, yeah, they had a business, but it was just a thing they weren't taking too seriously. And then when they started taking the tax side of it seriously, they turned it into a business.
Yeah.
One of my very first clients, I got them from your Discord server. And he was a guy who had been an IT professional who just changed over to being an independent contractor for the same company, but he was treating it like it's just a job. Yeah, I have a business and I'm saving some money by being able to write off stuff, but he wasn't treating it like a business. And it was, we talked and he was like, oh, I can get contracts from other people. And if I get too much work, I can hire contractors to work for me to do that work.
Yes.
And so within 2 years, he had nearly tripled his revenue, nearly doubled his profits, just by treating it like a business. So, like, treat it like a business. I mean, I use the term side hustle or side gig, but I kind of hate that term. Like, I have a business. And even when it was something making nearly no money, and I had a day job that was 95% of what I was making, I called it my business. I called it a side business, but I called it a business because sure. I wanted to treat it like a business, and words matter.
Words do matter. And there's also, like, there's creative ways to do this. Like what you just said with the contractor stuff made me think of this. One of the businesses Neil Franklin and I built was called Data Workforce. And we had about 2,500 contractors all over the world and about 50 in-house personnel. Some of our contractors, we didn't pay as contractors. They set up corporations, and we did corporate-to-corporate billing with them. Those were the smart ones. Now, they were all technical geniuses, right? But those were the monetarily smart ones. Some of them did what you said. They ran other things. They had other clients and what have you. But a lot of them worked exclusively for us, and there was still, like, massive advantage for them in the corporate structure. All they did was basically file some paperwork and then manage the money a little bit differently, and it opened up a lot of different things for them that otherwise they wouldn't have. Because we would do some, like, per diem and travel assistance and all, but it was flat rate. Like, they managed their own side of that. There was, like, a formula we had for, like, how far do you have to travel, where are you coming from, where you're going, but you handle your own airfare, car rental, all that stuff. And by setting that up as a business, they were able to do things like hire a personal assistant and legitimize that expense a lot more than if they were just a straight contractor.
Yeah, and I mean, you can do any of those things as a contractor, because that's still a business, that's still a Schedule C,
yeah,
sole proprietorship. But the IRS looks at Schedule C sole proprietorships much more carefully than basically any other type of business. Because the people running those types of businesses usually don't know what they're doing, because if they did, they'd target. Usually be doing it through an LLC or a corporation. And so the IRS is just kind of learned that that's like the easy juice to squeeze, is to go after those people. But no, also, like, the very first thing I do with all my clients is set them up as an LLC or very rarely as a corporation. And then for, I think, all but three of them I currently have, we get them set up as what's called an S corporation. And now you're not paying self-employment tax on anything. And, like, for a lot of people, that's a $5,000-$7,000 a year savings every single year. And again, like, it's, you got to set up, you got to do some paperwork. You got to set up a payroll and do a regular payroll for yourself as an employee. It takes 2 hours to set up and 10 minutes a month to manage. Yeah, I'll do that for $5,000 a year.
Yeah. Yeah. And you said you're avoiding the self-employment tax, but what you're really doing is reducing it because you can't pay yourself nothing.
Exactly.
Since I don't work with you directly, I don't know if this is a strategy you're using, but this is the strategy I'm familiar with. You pay yourself a reasonable salary, and you're going to pay SSI on that. You retain the rest as corporate earnings, and you pay it out to yourself as a capital gain, basically. Therefore, it's not subject as a labor rate, so it is not subject to SSI.
Exactly. You avoid all the FICA on it. Or self-employment tax, again, same tax called different things for different people.
Yeah, yeah. That's what most of our guys were doing. They were all S-corps that were doing corporate-to-corporate billing in the contractor field. That's kind of when I picked up on how that works. And like, oh, that's a little interesting thing to do right there. What's the difference between aggressive with your taxes and stupid with your taxes? Because I have a rule. We don't do stupid. You know, stupid was when I was 18. This is not a time for stupid in a grown man's world.
So first of all, anything where you can go to Club Fed is stupid.
Okay.
It's just flat out. Some things that don't end up in Club Fed are still stupid. And the biggest one I can think of is, you know, if you are it's not a crime to miscategorize expenses as long as there's an argument about what it should be.
Okay.
But if you know your writing off a whole lot of entertainment expenses, which are not deductible these days, as marketing expenses, that's stupid.
Okay.
Because, first of all, especially if you've been in business for a while and suddenly those numbers change a lot, the IRS sees those numbers change, and you're a lot more likely to get that letter in the mail. But that's also the type of aggressive where if they catch you doing something like that, you are way more likely to get an audit.
Yeah.
It's like, okay,
like, it looks
we caught you in.
Right?
Exactly. Like, it's either intentional or you're so ignorant, what else are you screwing up?
Yeah.
So it's kind of anything that's really, really, really aggressive in terms of, and then again, the biggest cases are you're taking something that you probably can't write off, but you're trying to write it off. That's where we maybe get to be stupid instead of aggressive.
Okay.
Really, again, it's kind of, I look at that cost-benefit ratio, you know? Do I think I have a good enough chance of winning this that my expected return on doing this 100 times pays off or not? If it does, it's aggressive. If it doesn't, it's stupid.
And I do like the, will this cost me money or will they put handcuffs on me? That's a clear delineation between, like, aggressive and stupid.
Exactly. Yeah. You can't do anything if you're in prison.
So, I mean, if I classify something as a marketing expense, then it really should have been an advertising expense because I use both of those. That's if it's still legitimate, it's not even really going to cost me anything in the end. It's just, oh, I called this thing the wrong thing. Whoops. I guess unless I'm Donald Trump, I'm in pretty good shape with that. However, if it's like I called it a marketing expense, but it was really me and my buddies partying at a strip club, no. No, especially if we don't run like a stripper recruitment business. Maybe I could make that work then, right? But if I'm not doing that and that's what I'm calling an expense, yeah, I probably shouldn't do that. And I don't know if I'm going to the Fed with that or I'm just going to have to pay a big fine, but either way, it's probably stupid.
Yeah, and then there's one other category of stupid, and that's spending money just to get a write-off.
Okay, yeah.
I literally, this is my last video I did on my YouTube channel. It's like, stop buying an SUV to save money on taxes if you don't need an SUV. Because spending $100,000 on an SUV to save $30,000 in taxes means you have $70,000 less. Now, if you need that SUV, great.
Sure.
But if you don't, like, don't just spend the money to get a write-off, it's costing you money.
I would say if you really, really want an SUV and you can cut the cost of it effectively, like, buy $30,000 with a tax write-off, sure, but don't do it for the tax write-off. I hear that all the time. Like, these people have a business that loses money just so that they can write the tax. No. No. I don't know who told you that, or I don't know where that came from, some movie or something that your dad saw in the 60s, but that is not how entrepreneurs work. Real entrepreneurs do not start businesses with the intention of losing money. If somebody's doing that, they're probably, like, money laundering or something. Like, they're, you know, like, they're not in that business to lose money for tax purposes. There's other, I could just hire you as a consultant and write you a check and piss that money away. And I'd have the same deduction.
I think it partly came out of the kernel of truth of in real estate, you can have paper losses.
Yes.
With actual gains.
Yes.
And there are a few other industries where it is possible on paper to be losing money, but you're actually making. So those do exist, but yeah, the idea that any business can do this, it's like, no. And in fact, you know, I've talked about it on your show before, and you've talked about it. Like, if you're not making money within about 3 to 4 years, that's a big red flag. You can get away with it. You know, I'm working with a guy doing a startup to do some heavy duty manufacturing. You know, we're talking about a $3 to $4 million factory he's building.
Okay.
If he's lucky, the first unit comes off of the assembly line about 18 months.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be a while before that business is profitable on paper. But that's the type of business that the IRS gets isn't going to be profitable on paper in 3 years because you have that huge upfront investment.
So that actually is interesting to me, and this is why. It is common for big companies to lose money for many years before they make their first profit. I think Amazon lost money for 6 or 7 years before they made a dollar. Technically, that would fall outside of the realm of, you know, they have a thing like if you don't make money after a certain number of times, either you have to stop doing it. It becomes a hobby and you're supposed to report the revenue without the expenses at that point, right? Big companies, I'm sure they don't do that.
So it's not quite. It's you're not a hobby if you're profitable 3 out of 5 years.
Okay.
But you're not automatically a hobby if you don't meet that.
Oh. There's
other tests.
Okay.
So it ratchets the other way, basically.
Okay. All right.
Because no, like there are businesses that, they look at things like, why are you not profitable? Right? Like, oh, you're not profitable because you've expanded the business. Like Amazon.
Capital intensive startup, right? I mean, like, yeah.
And those are the cases where they'll look at that, and they do that for farms, which have special rules and are more likely to be found hobbies. But like, there's a test, and one of the things is, would you have been profitable if you weren't reinvesting money back into the business?
Okay.
And if so, you're probably a business.
I got you. So that makes sense. Plus, once you scale to a certain size, somebody's paying taxes, right?
Exactly.
So if I'm running a farm business and I'm paying myself a salary and my business lost money, but I ran $70,000 worth of payroll to myself, I'm paying tax on that money. So that's different than a solopreneur that's not paying anything on either side of it.
Yeah, although in that case, you'd probably do better off not being an S-Corp, and then you don't have to pay yourself the salary.
Yeah.
And then, again, like I'd much rather you make $20,000 as a Schedule C than $70,000 as a salary and lose money on your company.
Sure.
Because you're actually going to owe more taxes that way.
Sure. I'm talking big companies here. Like, yeah. Amazon was paying a shitload of people a lot of money, so the government was getting a big old chunk of it even before Amazon paid a dollar in corporate taxes. And I also think that's why when people say something like, General Electric paid $0 in taxes. Yeah, I'm kind of honked off about that too. But how much did General Electric contribute to the tax base when you add up the sum total of everybody from the CEO down to the janitor and all the taxes that they paid? And the answer is a fucking lot.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Like, and I've seen the same thing with Amazon. I've seen the same thing with every big company. Yeah. It's like, I mean, imagine how much income tax they've paid on Apple salaries.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And how much legitimate expense. You look at some of these warehouses and go, gee, I wonder what the friggin' electric bill is on that place a month,
And so it's why, like, yes, the government wants taxes for money and they want exceptions on taxes so they don't pay. But, like, one of the justifications for a lot of these things is they want people to grow the economy. And so by giving tax breaks to companies in certain ways that grow the economy, like it actually does result in more taxes being collected eventually on net. So it's actually a good investment for the government.
Sure.
And so like there's lots of society useful things like hiring people, employing people, or providing housing that get special tax breaks. And I mean, this is something I'm now working with a lot more with some of my clients that have kind of grown their businesses. There's a lot of tax breaks when you add up your first real employee and provide benefits to them. Like you can actually set it up sometimes that is like, okay, I pay $500 to give this employee this benefit.
Okay.
And I save $750 in taxes this year.
Ah.
Now that's not forever.
Yeah.
It's like for 2 or 3 years. But it's good for you to get that. It's good for your employee. And yeah, you're kind of stuck them paying for that long term, but realistically, every business owner knows compensation is compensation, right? Like it's that squeezable balloon when you buy a car.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah, your benefits go up, but I'm now giving you that big of a raise. Okay, I don't care.
Yeah.
Right? I just care what does it cost me to employ you?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I've always told people. Like, you don't think when I used to hire people that when I was giving them a salary package, I thought about things like, oh gee, I'm gonna have to match your SSI. You don't think that we work that into their compensation package or this is how much it's going to cost us? You know, if we have that many employees, we might be like, well, not everybody's going to do the 401k, but the matching is going to apply to a 42% rate of the total. Like all those numbers go into the compensation package or the company that doesn't do that, they go this thing called bankrupt, right? You have to factor all those numbers in. And that's all part of that's why when you're like, well, why can't you pay me, $4 an hour more? Because I am. Because right. I already am when I do all the rate, like there's more than that in overhead. Like there's some employees you have almost more overhead on them than their direct cost.
Yeah, I mean a pretty good rule of thumb on that is it probably costs the employer at least 50% more than whatever the salary
yep.
is.
Yep.
And it can be a lot more than that. Like, the last job I got hired for, they didn't just have to hire me, they had to hire a paralegal for me.
Mm.
Well, at some point, like they were looking at how much money was I going to make them as an attorney, And they were looking at not just my comp, but they were looking at the comp of the support staff for that.
Sure. Same. I had a job one time. I was VP of sales, and I had a dedicated inside salesperson. I'm sure those two numbers went together as the total cost of this business unit. And then I'm the top of the business unit, so I'm the one that gets chopped if there's a problem. That's just business. And that's why I actually think that it's a good thing for people to actually learn about taxes. When you start thinking that way, not only do you become better at working the tax system and better at keeping more of your own money, you actually become a better entrepreneur. And I think you kind of alluded that to earlier, like all of a sudden the person started treating their business like a business and it grew. But it also leads you to good business strategy, because this is a funny thing. As much as we look at it as a game and like, if I do this, then I keep more of my money, usually they're good decisions for the business, even if there wasn't taxes to begin with. Like, it actually leads to a better structured, better disciplined business.
Yeah, there are things in the tax code where it's like, I'm just doing that because there's some tax credit or something.
Sure.
But probably 98% of everything I help businesses do when they set up, other than, again, a paperwork or a designation or something, is always something that is, in fact, good for the business. And even if that's, again, like, man, bookkeeping sucks. I hate bookkeeping. I really hate bookkeeping. But it is so important to do it well, and depending on your type of business, it is crucial, or you don't even know where you're losing money. I had one of my first clients who I took over the bookkeeping for her. She had like six different products she was selling. And when she finally sat down and was really looking at what am I making on each of these products, what is it costing on each of these products, she was losing $17 per sale on one of these products.
Oof.
And you might say, oh, well, it's a loss leader or something. No, this is like the one product that people bought if they never bought anything else. So it was 100% losing money for her, and she'd been selling for like 4 years.
Success leading to bankruptcy is what that is. That's what I'm talking
about. And again, thankfully, it was a small part of her business, so it wasn't like it wasn't like her profitable side made up for it. But it was like literally getting her bookkeeping set up caused her to cut a product that not only did she end up saving, you know, several thousand dollars a year, but she wasn't wasting her time on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that too. People don't factor in like cost of goods sold, and then they think this is profitable because the business is profitable. So everything, no, it's not. And if they choose to do some sort of major push with that product, like, you're just accelerating yourself towards death at that point. It's like a dude that's totally out of shape, you know, chugging whiskey and lard together and thinking he's helping himself. Like, no. Yeah, and there are people like that. Like, you realize if you're successful as you define it with this product, you're going to kill yourself. You're going to kill your business.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Just like, you can grow too quickly as well, and that's another way that success can kill you. Like, it is profitable, but, you know, I mean, especially, God, the stories I'm hearing now about people in manufacturing, and like, crap, I just sold $1 million worth of orders, and oh no, there's a tariff on the stuff from China. I'm going to now lose money on every one of these instead of making money on every one of these.
Alt supply is a good plan, man. that was always hard in, like, not even with tariffs or anything. It was always hard, like, in the data cabling business, though, because we were quoting jobs with, you know, 50,000 foot of cable. And that cable's all made out of copper. And copper is a commodity. And the price of that cable would swing by the week. Sometimes 10-15% up and down, you know, and it's just one of those things. Like, sometimes it would work to your advantage too. Like, you factored it in higher, and then something caused a dump in the copper market, and you could just delay your order side of supply. But you had to come up with some sort of running aggregate average to be able to confidently quote a customer. And see, like I said, that mentality strays right into understanding taxation. Because it will make you think that way in the first place.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's almost like every part of your business just fits together somehow.
Yeah. It's great. Anyway, just as an aside real quick for people watching, if you've seen a blur go by my screen a couple times, I have a little spider living on my camera, and I don't want to get rid of him. That's what it is. Every once in a while, he goes across the lens. Nothing to do with what we're talking about, though. But I just saw it several times, and I'm like, that's him or her or whatever it is. It's on the back end of the control now and hanging out. So can you think of some expenses that are like completely legal and probably really important that we actually, you know, pay attention to write off can have a real impact that people tend to just miss. Like they have the expense. It's totally legit. They don't even know they're missing it. It's just sitting out there. It's like low hanging fruit to reduce your tax burden.
So one of the easiest ones to forget to do is anything regarding mileage or use of your vehicle in the company. Because you're not writing a check for it directly. You know, even when you're paying gas or whatever, like there's so many other expenses either in terms of the mileage accounting for it or the actual costs. And so everything regarding the use of your vehicle is super, super easy to miss. And I mean, it's 70 cents this year.
That's a lot.
Per mile.
That's a lot.
And especially if you've got like some sort of a hybrid, you can practically make money driving your car at that rate.
Oh, you absolutely can make money driving your car at that rate.
So it's like, that's a super easy one to miss. I see people miss it all the time. Meals is another big one I push. You know, it's really, really easy to just leave the receipt on the table and walk away and not even document it.
Yeah.
And what counts as a business meal is actually very liberal. Like, if you discuss business for 5 minutes at a one-hour meal, that's a business meal. I know some people think, oh, the whole thing has to be about business, or it has to be, you know, a marketing person or whatever. And it's like, no, it's very broad. I mean, I have a monthly lunch with my best friend. He is an employee at another company, but he is a tech genius. He pays every other month. I pay every other month. But every single month, at least that I pay for, I make sure we talk about how can I use technology in my business, AI, Amazon Web Services, whatever. And I document what we talk about, and I write off that meal as a business expense. So those are both two super, super simple ones that, again, I see people, and even if they document it, you know, they forget a lot of it. I mean, I was doing somebody's tax return, you know, a little bit late. They did an extension. And it's like, okay, I'm looking at this, and you only have $74 in meals? And they're like, oh, yeah, I know I've done other things, but I didn't document it, and I didn't keep the receipts, and I some of them I use my personal credit card, some of the company credit card. And it's like, again, I just did the math. It's like, I mean, I know you're doing business meals. I know you probably could write off $1,000 a year. That's $300 in your pocket you just burned.
Yeah, yeah. One of the ones that I knew and I do, but I didn't really ever talk about it until recently when you did a segment for Expert Counsel, was the idea of you keep on the home office changing your mileage deduction. Because I'm not leaving, like, so I mean, for people that didn't hear that, like, let's say that I had to go do some errands for the show. I had to mail something, and then we had to go talk to somebody, and then my wife and I, who is a partner in the business, had lunch, but that's a meal expense, and then we came back home. Normally that would work. Our trip from the house to the first location is not a mileage deduction. And then from there on, it is. And then back home isn't either because you're going home. You have a home office, those two legs become a deduction. And
exactly.
That's huge. I really never thought of how big an impact that would be for other people. Because when you pointed it out, like you assumed the person would have a very small home office deduction. So even though we've always done that, like, I never really thought about it that way, just knew that I could do it because my home office deduction's huge. Where, like, for you're right, for a lot of people, maybe they have a one-bedroom apartment and they have a little area and it's 50 square feet, and that deduction's fairly small, but that expands the value of the deduction so hugely.
Yeah. And again, like, I think about when you were in Arkansas, like, that was probably a lot of mileage you could have written off that maybe you didn't. So, again,
yeah,
kind of
that actually I blew because I had an office. I didn't even think about staging a home office. That was 22 miles a day, 11 each way for two people, so 44 miles a day that we could have written off. We missed it only because we had an office and we didn't think, well, if we had a home office, and it, you're right, it could have been like, well, I had two extra bedrooms that nobody did anything with. It could have been just one of them.
You know, another thing I see on mileage is you can kind of batch trips together. So I work with a lot of homesteaders. You know, it's oftentimes a long drive into town. Well, if you need to go grocery shopping in town for yourself, but hey, I'm going to stop by the feed store to get something.
Okay.
Now that mileage may be business mileage. Now, I would not do that 5 days a week.
Like, sure.
You can't go by the feed store every single day to grab one thing.
Yeah.
But if you're not doing that at least once a week, I think you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
And again, like it, these little things do add up. I mean, I'm reading your book. You talk about, you know, don't be cheap, be frugal. This is about being frugal.
Yeah.
$20 here, $30 there, $40 there. It doesn't seem like much until you get to the end of the year, and it can very easily be thousands of dollars.
And then across decades and a lifetime, it can lead to thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars that you don't have, that you could have, that all it was is a record. That's all it was is just the record and how you structured the record. What do you say that somebody, like, they're afraid they're going to get in trouble?
So the first thing is learn. Learn more about it. Learn more about what is and isn't allowed. Hell, I'll even tell you the name of one of my competitors. Tom Wheelwright wrote a book. The name escapes me. It's on its third edition. But it's all about business taxes. I have sent copies of that to clients to read, to get just to learn basic information. And frankly, that's how I learned a lot of the stuff I did. Like, I did not study taxes in law school very much. I learned it by going out and reading books and following YouTube videos and finding people who actually knew what the hell they were talking about. And be careful on YouTube, because a lot of people do not know what they're talking about. But go out, again, anything you learn is going to be something that maybe you can use someday. Build the picture up. And again, like, I don't expect a business owner to go out and spend a week learning about taxes this year. But, I mean, find 30 minutes a week to just, you know, read another chapter in that book, to follow something, you know, go on YouTube to find something.
Like, you know, I would say, like, if your business makes any significant revenue, a lot of things can become tax deductible with the right setup. So if I'm going to spend a lot of money, I make a call to Mary, who's my CPA, and I ask her, is this an expense? And if she says no, instead of saying okay and hanging up the phone, I say, could it be? Could it be? And what she explains sometimes is like, just don't. Like, she's like, I love you and how aggressive you are, but don't. Or, yeah, but this is what, all the things you'd have to do. And it's like, that's probably not worth it. Or it could if you just did these two things. Well, we're doing those two things. Like, that's why I say having the good CPA is so important. And then if you have any thought that it could be deductible, you're not filing your taxes because you call your CPA, right? I think actually this is a weird thing, but I think some people, especially people that don't own businesses, they just go to like a H&R Block or, you know, something like that and file a 1040. They feel like the accountant is a government person. The accountant is not the accountant is your person. They're on your side. And you need to see them that way. And so that means you take anything you have to them. If I'm not sure and I haven't talked to her during the year, I'll just put that in the box to the side. And when we do our tax, I'll be like, well, is there a way we could use this? And she might say, well, no, you dumbass, you should have called me. And we could have. But next year, if you do it this way, we can. And just asking that question, like, you know, who should pay no taxes based on that? Jake Robinson. All the guy does is ask questions, right? Like, he probably gets fired by people as a customer just for asking too many questions. But there's a lesson there. Ask, because you don't know what you don't ask.
Yeah, the way you put it is kind of the way I put it. A good question is this deductible? The better question is, how can I make this deductible? And absolutely, sometimes the answer is, sorry, you can't.
No,
you cannot write off your country club dues. Like, there's in the tax code. You cannot write that off anyway, anyhow, period. No. Can I write off this cruise? Maybe, but it's basically impossible. Cruises have special rules. But ask the question, and again, you talk about this all the time. Your brain's a computer. The questions you ask it matter. Is this deductible? Well, yes or no, and you're done. How can I make this deductible? Now it's processing. Now it's thinking. And this is what I do myself. And sometimes I think of a solution, and it's like, that's going to save $50. It's going to take 5 hours of work to do it. No.
Yeah.
But, I'm going to save $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 a year, and it's going to take me an hour to do that. Yeah, I'll jump through those hoops.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the other thing is, like, CPAs tend to really like you asking questions like that, because if they're good CPAs with clients like you, then the thing they research and track down for you and structure for you, they go to the other clients and they go, hey, guess what? You can do this too. And then you just gave them value to their customer base. And then you're not the pain in the ass customer. You're the value add customer. I think that's why we have such a great relationship for our CPA, because we get creative and we bring her ideas. And then she goes, let me fix that for you. And then she backfeeds that through her whole client base.
Man, you're giving away all my secrets here. So the way I work with my clients, I give them, it's an ongoing fee, but it's unlimited email access to me to ask any questions. And they think I'm providing a service to them for that, but no. Like, at least about 1 in 5 of those questions I get is like I hadn't thought about that. Or, I should research that. And then I take that and I do send that email to 5 or 6 clients saying, hey, I just thought of this great idea.
Yeah. Yeah, and when you have that idea and you know your clients, you're not so big that they're just a database, and you're immediately like, that applies to Bill and Tom and Sue, right? Like immediately you make that connection. They have a very similar structure to what they're doing. Yes, Ray can do this, but so probably can these other people. And that is how we learn anyway. Like, that's real learning. That's not learning out of a book. That's real world, actionable learning. What's your goal when you're helping somebody with their taxes? Like, what's your biggest mission?
It's really two at one. One is, let's save as much money as possible. And okay. I mean, if I don't think I can save somebody more than they're going to pay me in a year, I don't take them as a client. Barring very limited circumstances. But the second thing is peace of mind.
Okay.
Like, I want my clients, I want the people I work with to be more confident, to be better able to focus on their business because they're not freaking out over the taxes. So a big part of what I do with my clients, I try to do is more even educational stuff than direct tax saving stuff. And some of that's also, like, I know a lot about taxes. I will probably know more about taxes than 99% of the people who ever listen to this. But I will never understand your business as well as you do.
Correct.
And so I need you to know enough about taxes to ask me the right question for me to see what I can do to help you that maybe applies only to you of all my clients.
Okay.
And again, getting rid of fear, education. Education is the best way to resolve those doubts. And that's the one case I'll take a client I'm not going to save money to. I did one last year. It's like, man, I think you're probably going to lose $1,000 hiring me. And it's like, I don't care. I am freaking out about this. I am anxious about it. I just want it done right. Mm. Okay. I'll take your money then, because I'm still giving you value at that point. I don't feel bad about taking it. I'll do it. But that is the only exception I make to, I will not take a client if I cannot save them money.
Yeah.
You are so anxious, so freaking out about it that you're just not able to function. Yes, I that's the people I want to help the most, honestly.
I think there's also probably people that you're not going to profit this year from my advice, but the structure that we'll set up over the next 5 years will be profitable. Because it's like some of the things you do maybe annually, but some of the stuff you do is pretty much, we've set this up now. Now you're in a different corporate structure, or now you've moved this thing. Now you're not running you're not paying SSI on this. And no, that's not going to recoup this year. But since you're never going to do it now, now you're going to be profitable for, another 10 years. This is going to apply.
Yeah. I still won't usually even take a client then, because so much can change in the tax code.
Okay.
That I'm not comfortable enough with assuming it's going to pay off over the 5 years.
I appreciate that, because when financial advisors start telling me about what my taxes are going to be in 20 years when I'm retired, I'm like, you don't know that. You don't have any idea what my tax rate will be with this level of income in 2040. You don't know that, and please don't insult my intelligence. Like you said, you may not know what it's going to be next year. You damn sure don't know what it's going to be in 20 years.
And particularly right now, because we have the Trump tax cuts ending, but there's a bill that's just been passed by one of the committees that's going to extend some of those. Like, you literally have no idea what it's going to be next year or in 2 years or in 3 years.
Yeah.
Like, there's about four different places it could be that are very different places depending on what happens here in the next 6 months.
Yeah, personally, my prognostication, I don't think they'll let them expire. And I think there actually might be some good new things coming. But I also have a very strong gut feeling that it'll be just like last time, in that all the stuff that's good will have an end date and have to be reapproved sometime in the future. You know, if they would stop doing that, then if they wanted to change it, they'd have to go through the process again. But there's a lot of laws like that that have basically, when it benefits us, they always seem to have sunset dates. When it benefits them, it never seems to have a sunset date on it.
Yeah. And again, I'm not focusing too much on it because it's constantly changing, but it definitely is in my area of concern what the tax laws are. So, you know, I'm spending 15, 20 minutes a day right now just following up on that. And you know, sometimes it's, you know, letting clients know, because, again, I'm doing tax planning for people. And it's like, well, and I got one guy right now, it's like, we're in a holding pattern because the way the law currently is, you save money this way.
Yeah.
But if the Trump tax cuts end, you lose money doing that.
Okay.
And this is not the thing we can necessarily change overnight.
Yeah.
So it's like, we're literally just like, I will give you good advice as soon as I know what the good advice is.
We're going to hold fire until the enemy is clear, right? Like the basic common sense things there. Are there some ways that people can start treating what they do like a business, even if they don't think of themselves as entrepreneurs?
So first of all, I kind of go back. I think even in your job, you should try to think like an entrepreneur. Because that's the way to succeed in anything, is entrepreneurship, is taking some ownership of what you're doing. You know, I think everybody should have some sort of a business or a side hustle. I mean, I'll tell you right now, there's a law proposed in Texas that my personal injury day job would basically go away if this law passes.
Oh, wow.
And I know a lot of personal injury attorneys who are really freaking out about it because they have a job and that's it. You know, it will cost me money if this happens, but I'm literally not losing any sleep over it because I've got something else going on.
Sure.
So really my advice is just find something you can do, even if it's literally just Ubering, DoorDashing, whatever. That's valuable just to learn how to do it. I've had, depending on how you count it, anywhere from 14 to 16 businesses. Most of them failed.
Yeah.
I think four of them had revenue and only two of them were profitable. Get back up, try something else, do something else. You will succeed eventually, and you'll, as long as you learn from what you do, you'll succeed eventually.
Yeah, I think there's also just like think. So this is probably not going to apply to anybody listening. Maybe it'll apply to one or two after the whole thing goes out. I had a friend. He had run businesses his whole life. He decided to take a job because it was a really good, very high-paying job with a lot of opportunity for what would come next. And so he shut down his businesses, and he took this job. And because of – there was a lot of similarity between the two. Because of that, he was able to take existing contractors he used in his business and throw work to them over the fence and acquire new business for the company he was now employed at. But that was not his job. His job was basically project management. So he's project managing one project at a time, and that's what his salary and bonus schedule is on. But should he basically become a salesman on the side and give the company business, then he had a riff for that. And then he like looked at his taxes and he was like, this blows. I mean, this guy had paid business, had paid taxes as an entrepreneur for 20 years, and now he's paying all his income as taxes as an employee. And I'm like, bro, you still have three corporations. They're just not running in revenue. Take one of your corporations, go to your employer and say, here's what I want to do. I want my incentive compensation only for sales on a corporate-to-corporate billing from my company. That's all you have to do. And like that one thing, because he's not – you're not mixing the streams there, because these are totally different functions, and you can own the company and the company is doing the sales and the company is receiving the money and you're just the owner. And that's, I'm not like, I'm going to say that is a very unique situation to be in, to be working for a company with a six-figure salary, to be able to be throwing million-dollar contracts over the fence to them. That's probably a very small portion of the world can do that. But it's the strategic nature of that seeing it that way.
Well, and it made me think of what is sometimes the easiest way to do it is go talk to your employer about becoming a contractor instead of an employee.
Ah.
Now, depending on your situation, that may be a terrible idea. If you need the benefits or if they're going to take advantage of the fact that now they can get rid of you and not pay unemployment or anything, this can burn you. But I know, I mean, a third of my clients are basically people who were either IT people or doctors or dentists who were employees who just switched over to being independent contractors with a business. And they just turned their job into a business. And again, they get all those business write-offs that were not available for them as an employee. So that again, and that depends on your employer. And a lot of employers will say no.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, keep it in your back pocket next time you're looking for a new job. Instead of applying to be an employee, apply to work for them as an ongoing contractor.
Yeah.
You know, like, yes, it technically can hurt to ask, but really it can't hurt to ask, right?
Yeah.
Like, unless you're just a screw-up employee they want to get rid of anyway, you know, go talk to your boss about it. And if they say no, okay, well, no. But if they say yes, or if they say, well, maybe, go back, how can we make this work?
Yeah.
And it's really simple if you structure it right to, again, suddenly 5% drop in taxes, 10% drop in taxes – just by doing that, you know,
and
that's going to be thousands of dollars.
You can usually get a better rate because they're not carrying some of the overhead now. But there's like one of the reasons your employer may object to that. There's litmus tests if you're really a contractor. Like if I can tell you where you have to be every day at exactly what time and exactly the way you have to do things, you're really not a contractor. Now, if I say this is corporate procedure, and when you work for us as a contractor, you have to follow this, but you basically run your show. Now you're a contractor. So if your job is on an assembly line screwing lamps together, you're probably not going to pass that test.
Well, and even then, they're not going to care about you. Like you got to be a professional of some level to pull this off.
Yeah.
This used to work in every state. It currently does not work in a few states that have messed with independent contractors.
Let me guess, California.
California was the first. New Jersey also. And I think, actually of all places like North Dakota, set up an LLC.
Yeah.
And if you're an LLC, you cannot be an employee other than in a very limited number of states.
Yeah.
And frankly, if your current employer knows what they're doing, they're going to tell you.
Yeah.
Okay. To do that, you have to go set up an LLC and we've got to pay the LLC.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, yes, under the tax law, you will be an employee. And, like, really nobody cares if you're an employee or an independent contractor as long as you're paying your taxes.
Yeah.
But if you don't pay your taxes, that's when the IRS will go after your employer and say, this is an employee, not a contractor. You should have done withholding, and now you owe all of the money you should have withheld, plus penalties and interest.
Yeah. We paid California $300,000 one time. That wasn't fun. That wasn't fun at all. Now, it doesn't surprise me that New Jersey is a problem. You can't even pump your own damn gas in New Jersey still. But North Dakota, that's a little odd. I would have not – if you said there were three, I would have never picked any of the Dakotas.
I think it's North Dakota. It's North Dakota or it's Montana or it's something. Okay. And it's not as bad as the California one. Like,
okay.
You can still set up the LLC and do it a lot easier and get it to work. Like California, no. They just it's a dumb law and it's – I mean, even for California, it was a dumb law.
Yeah. If someone's just waking up to how predatory the tax system is, what are their first steps?
Again, go back to it. First step is education. First step is figuring out how taxes work. Some of that education also needs to be kind of just basic finance stuff. You know, like if you don't understand what we mean by a marginal tax rate, you need to figure that out. And I'm amazed. I had parents who taught me about financial stuff when I was younger, so I knew how this works. But if you've ever heard somebody say, man, I got a raise and now I pay more and I'm losing money because my taxes went up, that actually can happen in very limited circumstances.
Yeah.
Credit. But from the tax rate, it's like, no, no, you only pay the higher amount on the extra money, not on all the money.
Yeah.
But a lot of people do think if you're at the 22% tax bracket, you're paying 22% on every dollar owed. You're not. If you're in the 22% tax bracket, you're probably actually paying less than 10% of your income in taxes. You're just paying 22 cents on that last dollar.
Yeah, yeah. Or whatever's over that bracket. It's yeah, the marginal tax rate thing is something a lot of people struggle with. I think it also sometimes feels that way to them when they look at what's being withheld, because they got a raise of X and then it's the Y that actually netted the increase is lower, but the overall pay is still higher. And, you know, a lot of that also could be handled with, like, how are you doing your withholding? Like, some people, like, the reason you have a giant tax return and you get a big chunk of your money back is because you're having your employer over withhold. Now, if you want to do that, but you should know that's what you're doing, I think. And that's really not a tax reduction question, but it's just a tax understanding thing. Like, I see people, the way that they're doing their withholding, I'm like, you know, the problem with what you're going to pay it, you're going to have to pay by the time this is all over with. And that's okay too, if you know, right? If you know, then fine. But if you don't know, then that's not, you know, it's not good.
And it goes back in education. Like, ignorance is not a defense when it comes to the taxes. Ignorance causes many, many problems. There are horror stories. You and I talked about this on my very first appearance. Some guy trading money or trading on Robinhood who made 60 grand trading GameStop and owed like 300 grand in taxes because he didn't understand about watch sales.
Yeah.
Ignorance is expensive. I had a client's permission for this year. A guy up in New Hampshire has been in business for a couple of years. The business really took off last year. Well, there's a business tax in New Hampshire that kicks in once you do over, it's about $110,000. And it's like 7%
mm-hmm.
that rate. And it's not just over the 110, it's on everything. Well, if he had been an S Corp, that wouldn't have been business profit. It would have been payroll to him. So his business profit would have been low enough that tax didn't hit him. So not only was he not saving the $5,000 or $6,000 or $7,000 by being an S Corp, but he got hit with this about $8,000 plus business tax, $15,000. And it was literally just
structure.
He didn't know. And I was only doing his taxes at the time. He was not coming to me for advice. And I had no idea. I wasn't doing his bookkeeping. So I had no idea. Hey, Gavin, you're about to hit this level where it's going to change. And so by the time we figured it out, well, it's too late. So ignorance really is the enemy. Like, that's the problem. And then the other thing is, don't think you're too smart.
Yeah.
There is actually a section of the tax code that talks about if you're like running things through this big chain and it results in taxes not being owed, that's not valid.
Mm.
Like, there's just a rule that, like, no, you can't, if all these things you're doing are only because it affects your taxes, there's no other business purpose, then you can't do it. Like, the letter of the law actually matters less than the spirit at some level when it comes to this.
Gotcha.
So, like, if you find this brilliant loophole, first of all, it probably doesn't work that way. But even if it does, it may not work that way.
Yeah, it might be what you're saying is the thing itself might be legal, but if you can't show why the business should be doing it in the first place, and you're only doing it to do it, then it's not legal.
And again,
that sounds like bullshit, but it also sounds like government.
Well, and it's the time it comes up is not when it's you make one change in your business and affects your taxes. It's, okay, I do this, and now I do this, and now because of this random thing, this applies, and now I'm like seven steps later, and oh, look, I owe no taxes.
Okay.
Even if the IRS can't actually find a way to invalidate one of those steps, they can basically come in and say, you did that, all of it, purely for the tax effects. That's not a business purpose. You can't do it.
Interesting. Interesting. So if somebody wants to talk to you more, maybe retain you to do some work for them or just connect with you, how should they do that?
So best way is agoristtaxadvice.com/TSP. You'll get a report from me on a bunch of things you can think about for other things to write off for your business. I've also just set up the Agorist Tax Toolkits that I send to everybody as well. That's got things like an expense reimbursement sheet, and a solopreneur simple contract you can use, a couple other things like that. Do that, get on my email list, and then you'll have my direct email. Email me to set up an appointment to talk with me. I have a phone call with everybody before I take them on as clients. I want to make sure we're a good fit. I want to make sure I can help you. And we go from there.
And I'll make sure Matt's contact information is available in the audio notes today. If you're watching this on video, either live in real time or after the fact, right down there in the video description, there's a lot of yummy links, not just to that, but some other really good stuff. So you should check that out. I know nobody that watches videos on Facebook or YouTube or Rumble or whatever looks down there in the video description, but you should, because you might learn something. Anyway, Matt, thanks for hanging out with us today and bringing a lot of value to the show and to the audience. And the other thing is, guys, please send me questions for the expert counsel. That way I don't have to beat up on them and tell them, hey, I don't have enough content. Make your own stuff up. Send us questions, TSPC expert in the subject line, who it's for. And before you go, is there any particular areas that maybe people should think about sending you some questions in?
You know, anything you have, and the thing I would say is, even if you think it's dumb or simple or whatever, that's the best time to ask, because I guarantee you other listeners are going to benefit from that question. This is my biggest problem. I know so much, I forget to talk about the basics sometimes.
Yeah.
So if you've got any sort of a question, send it in. But also, I just got a question from Jack last week, and it's on something that, like, I had to do a lot of research on, and it was on timber. And that was just fun, because I had looked into that years ago, but I hadn't really looked into that. So if you've got, like, a really off-the-wall question that's a real question, like, I'm actually doing this,
yeah,
send that question in. I may prioritize that question a little bit, just because it's more interesting to me to learn this stuff, too.
You know, we kind of alluded to this. I think it would also be interesting when somebody hears this thing and it sounds like this wonderful thing, and this guy says, you don't have to pay taxes again or whatever. You know, you might send that in, and Matt might debunk the crap out of that and save you from doing something really dumb. Because I get at least one email a week, Matt, that says, Jack, do you know you can never pay any taxes ever again? And you'll get it. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to Club Fed. And that's the kind of shit that is stupid to go to jail side of the card.
Yeah, I get so tired of all that sort of stuff myself. And I mean, I was at a event a few months ago and someone was talking about, you know, I wrote all of my personal expenses through the business expenses and, you know, ended up having $1,000 or $2,000 in profits a year and basically paid no taxes and never got in trouble. And it's like, okay, that's called getting lucky.
Yeah.
Like, and that's called you were in business for 7 years and then you retired. They're going to catch you eventually. And yes, some people get away with flat out tax fraud for years or decades. It happens. It's not smart. Just because somebody else got away with it doesn't mean it's allowed.
Exactly. Exactly. And that will not be allowed admitted into your trial. But he got away with it. They don't care. We caught you. Hey, man, thanks for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Always glad to be here.
All right, guys, real quick, let's wrap up. I want to do a couple of things. Number one, the AI course. There's a lot of people interested in it. How to become dangerous as a solopreneur with ChatGPT. You can pre-register for the course. We are not actually taking payment for it yet. We're building a list, and I'm going to tell you right now it's going to sell out. But we made a bit of an error, Tom and I, both working two different sides. It doesn't really affect anything, but a lot of you are asking questions about it. You may have signed up yesterday or forward and got a result page that said you're supposed to get an email with a link to click in it, and you got an email but not a link to click in it. That's okay. I turned off what's called double opt-in, where you have to click the link to actually be on the list, because that causes problems for some people. So I shut it off, and Tom didn't fix the result page that said you successfully opted in. He just fixed the email that you get. So don't worry about it. If you put your name and email in a form and you got an email that said, we got it, you're on the list and you're good to go. And when we're ready to put it up for sale, which will probably be pretty soon, you'll get an email saying it's coming. And then you'll get an email saying it's available, right? So we'll let you know in advance, because this thing is going to fill fast. I'm talking minutes here, not hours. It's just going to be the way, and there's going to be some of you pissed at me, like I didn't get in. The way we're running this and the attention we're putting into it and the way that we're structuring it, I can't take 200, 300, 400, 500 people. I can take 100. And that's based on figuring out how many of you are going to be really serious and involved in the Telegram group and all, and Tom and I being able to support that group. So the last thing I want to do is sell, 500 courses and then everybody be pissed because they don't feel like we delivered what we promised. So we're going to limit to 100. And then when that 40-day cycle wraps, we'll keep running this as long as there's interest in it. And hopefully it'll keep getting made better. And the people that come in early, you will be able to gain from anything we add in perpetuity. All right. So that's that. Next up, real quick, I don't have an item of the day for you because I got a book out, right? So my book is the item of the day all week. Laws of Life, Ditch the System, Design Your Life. It's gone really well. We've hit bestsellers. We've slipped some from where we were on launch day. We had a huge surge, but we're still in like top positions in every major category of the book still today, a couple days later. Thank you guys for that. If you have not picked up a copy yet, please do so. If you have picked up a copy, but you're like, this is great, consider picking up some as gifts. And it's really cool. Like if you just order it and tap it sent straight to that person, they might be actually more likely to read it if you did that. And again, guys, thanks to everybody that's helped make that book a success. It's kind of blown me away how quickly we were able to actually get traction with that. And now we're getting things like we're being associated with other authors and other books and like people that like this book, like that book. And that was the hope. It was the plan and it was the strategy and it was the way that I built the whole system for it. But when it actually happened, that's different than thinking it's going to happen. So thank you to everybody. Tomorrow will be an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. We'll probably even have a segment by Mr. Sersley here. I think that's in one of the queues coming up for tomorrow. But I still have time to take questions. TSPC expert in the subject line. Ask the question or tell me who the question's for. My question is for, Ryan Steva, Matthew Sersley, Nick Ferguson, whoever. My question is one sentence, question mark, return. Put some space in there so my eyes don't glaze over all the details you want to give. And that way you'll be very, very likely to get an answer from the expert council member of your choice. I'll also say we've made some changes in addition to the expert council recently. I've cut a few people who just weren't getting stuff back to me. I've added quite a few people over the last couple of months. That's given us some real diversity. I am always open to considering someone else for the expert council, especially if you do something or talk about something that we don't already have. If you want to know who you can send questions to or if you're a good fit and if you occupy a space that we don't have already, go to thesurvivalpodcast.com, use the About tab, and look as you hover over it, it'll be a drop-down menu. Click on Meet Your Expert Council. You can see all the council members, their bios, what they do, who they are, their websites. And if you're like, man, I could add to this team, send me an email. Let me know about that. TSPC on the subject line and tell me a little bit about yourself. Don't go crazy with it. Bonus points. Bonus points come this way. Send me a 5-minute sample of what you would do. I'm answering, I'm so-and-so. This is what I do. I'm answering a question today about, or I'm going to talk about an audition. Because what you write will have absolutely nothing to do with your ability to present. It's an audio show, right? You have to be a good audio presenter to fit in. But I'd love to have more people. I think the more diverse we can make the council, the better. And if I have, if I could have one or two or three more people, then I would never have those weeks where I'm like, am I going to have enough? So with that, I'll catch you tomorrow. We have plenty for tomorrow. Take care, guys, and thanks for all your support. Just run you round. They said you should have a house. American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.